Have you ever been in court, Will?
I have.
Have you?
Yeah, I actually have. My dad, when I was a little kid, my dad used to work for the county council, and their offices shared the same old building as an old courthouse. So he was on the first floor or second floor, whatever it was, and you could go across a little walkway in this creepy old building, and you could open a door and you would end up in the balcony and the top above the judge's head, and you could open up the door and there would be proceedings going on below you.
Guilty.
I remember creeping in or just opening the door and just kind of listening in and closing the door, being afraid I would be thrown into the slammer. But it really made an impression on me. Yeah.
But you were never in the dock for something you did.
No. So, have you ever been in court? No, is my answer. Continue.
Okay. No, you've ruined my joke. There's no joke now.
I know I have. I know I have.
Okay, let's just get into it. Court is in session.
Guilty.
The best bits.
I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
You are stupid. You have no taste, a lousy sense of humor, and you smell.
Don't call me stupid.
All rise. Welcome to the Best Bits Movie Podcast, where we present the evidence for our favourite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes. I'm your co-host Kevin, a writer of 100-bit films and 400-bit episodes of TV, and I'm joined by my co-host, a writer of 3 films, a Christmas special, and a Star Wars, Will Collins. That's shite. That's really
so it's guys.
Shite. I know I could have done better, but you know what? I'm at a stage now where it's like, just get it done. Just get on mic, get it done. How are you, Will?
You're the type of lawyer who's, you know, you're hungover. You've got one of those pro bono cases. You're just dragging yourself into the courtroom. Your tie is askew. Your shirt is all wrinkled. And you're bleary-eyed and you're looking at this poor defense. The kid that you're supposed to defend. You're supposed to defend. And you're like, you'll be all right. Grand.
It'll be grand. Just plea out. Plea out. I didn't do it. That's grand. Yeah. Put me away for 6 years. Yeah, but if I up to the judge, they're going to get 20 to life. He doesn't like me at all.
I'll put it to you this way. Do you want to be stuck in this room for one day or a week? I much prefer to be out of here in one day. I don't know about you. Just say guilty and you can all get out here quick. Yeah. You don't have to look at me. I don't have to look at you.
Will, I have to tell you, I know less now than I did before when it comes to judicial passes.
You just pulled a me. I'm so glad to hear you completely do a head over heels on some words. That's funny.
I'll edit all that out.
Judicial.
The judicial process.
Right.
The US system is so different to the UK and the Ireland system.
Yeah.
I had to view this more as theatre.
Yeah.
Because there are certain types of stories where I don't know what's going on, but I trust the commitment of the performers and the writers that they know what they're doing. So even though to me that seems awful fucking queer altogether, I just go along with it because they're all so committed. But I don't have a fucking clue how the courts work. But boy, I enjoyed an awful lot of these films that I saw for the first time.
Oh, dude, listen, courtroom dramas, they're the best sort of theatrics. I've always enjoyed a good courtroom drama because it's a perfect setting. It's a perfect staging for any sort of drama. It's a clear contest of one side versus another, and there's a clear endpoint. The stakes are incredibly high because someone's fate is in the hands of the prosecutor, the defense, and the jury. And there's always characters have been laid bare, stripped apart, pushed into corners. And you can actually explore that setting from multiple points of view. There's a reason why there's always an abundance of courtroom dramas, just inherently dramatic and compelling and interesting.
Well, the most recent one I think we can talk about first then, because I just watched Clint Eastwood's maybe final film, Juror Number 2.
Okay, what's the problem?
Called for jury duty. The Kendall Carter case.
1 year ago, on October 25th, the defendant, James Seith, and his then girlfriend, Kendall Carter, they had a fight. He's going to pay for what he did.
Maybe I didn't hit a deer.
Let me just ask you one thing. Did you guys ever look at any other suspect? You know what to do.
Have you seen it?
Right. I have seen over half of it, and I meant to go back and finish before Christmas, but I forgot to
and
go
I'll
back.
Spoil away. You've seen enough to be able to have a reaction similar to myself, which is that I thought, wow, that is a brilliant concept. That is a great premise for a movie. I wish I had it, even though I don't know that I'd have the patience to be able to write a film like this. Mm-hmm. It has the same class that a lot of Clint Eastwood's best films have, but it also has a few of his more recent issues, which is that I get the sense that he's moving at a pace that he's letting down the performers and he's letting down the crew and stuff. It needed a little bit more finessing. Some of the performances are a little bit amateurish, like some of the other jurors.
He famously just does like the fewest amount of takes possible. It's like, okay.
And I don't think he does any rehearsal either.
He doesn't
he
even do
the rehearsal.
He doesn't even do rewrites.
I love him then. My God, I want to work with him.
Yeah. When he signs on to do a script, I remember it was a guy who I think wrote the script for Invictus, the guy who did those, the Queen
Matt Damon
and whatnot.
Rugby film.
No, I'm talking about the guy, the screenwriter. Oh yeah, Invictus, that's what that movie is. But the screenwriter who did The Queen and that kind of trilogy of special relationship movies. And he...
Oh, the Crown writer.
No, not The Crown. There was The Queen, the one that was
the fella that wrote The Queen did The Crown.
Oh, also did The Crown, okay. But I remember an interview with him around Invictus when he heard that his film was...
Podbot, what's his name?
Peter Morgan,
that's the guy.
Thanks, Podbot.
I remember an interview with him where he said he was so excited when he heard that Clint Eastwood was going to direct Invictus, which I believe he wrote. And he said, I can't wait to get in and start rewriting with him and hear his notes on the script and whatnot. And he never met Clint Eastwood because Clint Eastwood's process is, that's the script. I am making that script. I'm shooting it. And that was it. And I believe it's pretty much the same with all of the creatives where it's like, right, we just get this done as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Well, juror number two follows Nicholas Holt, who is the second juror on this case where... In the midst of them laying out the evidence, he realizes that he is responsible for the death of the person that the defendant is being charged with their murder for. So he was at a bar when there was a fight that broke out between this couple, and all the evidence points to that he had a violent temper and he beat her to death and threw her into a ravine. But when he's sitting on the stand, it's all coming back to him that he drove home that night and he thought he hit a deer, and he got out of the car, looked around, saw a deer crossing, looked into the ravine, saw nothing, thought, what the hell did I hit there, and drove off. And now he realizes that he's killed that woman, not the guy in the dock, and he doesn't know what to do. And he speaks to a lawyer, speaks to Kiefer Sutherland, who's only in it for like two scenes, and says to him, what do I do? And he says, you're in whatever state it was, but it's like, if you come forward, vehicular manslaughter, you're going to get 20 years. Mm. And so he's stuck between a rock and a hard place, knowing that the person is 100% innocent. He cannot come forward. And he doesn't want anyone to start picking apart the case too much because it will lead directly to him. There were only 12 cars that had an accident similar to the one that on the night of the murder. And I was just riveted. It was just such an airtight, excellent premise. And thinking, how is he going to get out of this? And it kept twisting and turning. And J. Jonah Jameson is in there as an ex-cop. And he's like starting to sniff around. And Toni Collette is the prosecutor. And she's brought this case together a little too quickly. And now she's starting to have doubts. And I just thought it was really, really excellent. And such a fantastic final film for Clint Eastwood to go out on. It's a terrible shame that Warner Brothers buried it, because I think it would have done quite well as a theatrical release. But, you know, Warner Brothers seem to be in a position of wanting to destroy themselves.
Mm. So. All these films that you're just not supporting or not putting any marketing behind whatsoever, or simply not even releasing, it's a bit tragic. I will go back and finish it. What happened was, it's simply I got other titles came, you know, barreling down atop me to try and get watched before the end of the year. I will go back and finish that one.
Will we talk about...
I thought, sorry, Kevin, when you said I got to bring up a recent one, I thought you were going to bring up the big courtroom movie from last year.
Anatomy of a Fall.
Yes, Anatomy of a Fall.
Well, I know that you've seen that because we both had that on our top 10 list of the year before last.
Yes. Yeah. Is that on your list?
It's on my list, but I had so many blind spots, Will, and I'm going to shock you with the number of films that I had to watch for the first time for this. I always discover classics when I do this, and it's one of the reasons why I love this podcast, but I didn't revisit that one. I had a good sense of it. I really enjoyed that film. I remember we talked about me thinking that was a much more evolved way to trial a case, whereas you thought that was a horrendous way to trial a case because it was so open to influence.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, it's like all the facts are like out in the open. You can't really hide. There's no way for you to hide. Whereas you thought it was like, no, you can completely manipulate the situation there. Because if you are an articulate speaker or a convincing defendant, then you can swing that entirely in your favor by just playing on the jury and playing on the tribunal, I guess, of judges.
Yeah. And it feels like it's much less weighted on facts. The outcome of the actual trial is much less weighted on facts and more on speculation and opinion and who's won the popularity contest almost, with who shouted the loudest or made their case the best in the room. And I think...
Objection.
Unfortunately, though, I think what the best films of this genre depict...
Wigs.
...is that everyone is susceptible to influence. It's all about which side tells the best story, sells the best case. It's malleable.
These aren't just like a battle of wits, they're like a battle of ego as well.
Yeah.
There's always some hard-headed, stubborn, wrong person who will not admit they got it wrong.
So can I ask you, because I lapped up in the 90s, I would say the 1990s was a golden era for courtroom cases.
That's where I was watching a lot of blind spots.
Yeah, just so did John. Like, I read nearly all of the John Grisham books. Like, I fell for that stuff.
Can
like,
you read?
I do read, every now and again. I read the back
of that.
Crisp packets and cereal boxes. So I lapped up all that stuff and I thoroughly enjoyed all of those adaptations from The Firm, right through to The Pelican Brief and whatnot.
Okay, let's get rid of the ones that I know we've talked about before. To Kill a Mockingbird, Anatomy of a Fall, In the Name of the Father. Those are ones where we've talked about them a lot. Great court case films. In the Name of the Father, one of the most emotional ones. I think those scenes where Emma Thompson is like pushing back against these bastards.
This alibi for Jerry Conlon was taken by Mr. Dixon 1 month after Jerry Conlon was arrested. This note was attached to it when I found it in police files. It reads not to be shown to the defense. I have one question to ask you, Mr. Dixon. Why was the alibi for Jerry Conlon, who was charged with the murder of 5 innocent people, kept from the defense?
Fantastic courtroom scenes. Like, really riveting and emotional. Anatomy of a Fall, incredibly elegantly made and still leaves me in doubts. I don't know whether she did it or didn't do it. She was such an odd character. I feel like she did do it.
Yeah. I think it was the dog. I believe it was the dog, ultimately. He was the real killer behind everything.
Have you seen my dog?
God, it could be.
It could be. You never know. But it was a great...
That dog was an incredible actor.
He was actually brilliant. Sandra Huller, isn't it? Is Sandra Huller is the name of the actor. And she was nominated for 2 Academy Awards last year for Best...
They nominated her twice for that film. Actually have another one.
That and Zone of Interest, talk about having...
What a year.
What a fucking year to have both of those films out in the 1 year is absolutely phenomenal. Go on, Kevin.
And To Kill a Mockingbird, that came up for you as your pick for opening credits. That was such a fun episode.
Yeah.
And that final scene when he loses the case... And the black people that are in the pew looking down tell the little girl to rise. Her daddy's leaving.
Miss Jean Louise. Miss Jean Louise, stand up. father's passed.
But we've talked about them a lot, so I thought I would just mention them early.
Just sneakily slide in a point here is that courtroom drama films, like in the case of To Kill a Mockingbird, they point out societal injustices at the time.
Philadelphia?
This is one of my picks. This is not my main pick, but a film I was going to bring up. Absolutely.
All right, then I will bounce from that then and say that it's not just that you have courtroom dramas, you've also got courtroom comedies.
Yes.
And one that I didn't rewatch for this, but I know that it needs to be brought up. Aside from Ghostbusters 2, obviously, which is a phenomenal courtroom scene. Like, one of the best.
There was no evil intended, no malice. Because you live here, when you live in a place and you love it like you do, you don't want nothing bad to happen. What? Because it'll never happen again. It's an isolated incident. It's a one-shot deal.
Objection, Your Honor.
What?
He's leading the witness.
Sustained.
Give me a break. We're both lawyers.
Justice for Ernie Hudson. He should have been there in the dock with the rest of them. It doesn't make sense to me that they sidelined them.
Sorry, I missed it.
Yeah, it's a film that I didn't rewatch for this, but it has to come up. Legally Blonde.
Oh, do you know what?
What?
I've not watched it from beginning to end.
That doesn't surprise me because you don't like films that.
Well, according to Swinney versus Newbert, Swinney, who was also a private sperm donor, was allowed visitation rights as long as he came to terms with the hours set forth by the parents. So if we're sticking to past precedent, I mean, Mr. Latimer wasn't stalking. He was clearly within his rights to ask for visitation. Without this man's sperm, the child in question wouldn't exist.
Now you're thinking like a lawyer. Yes, Ms. Woods.
Although Mr. Huntington makes an excellent point, I have to wonder if the defendant kept a thorough record of every sperm emission made throughout his life.
Interesting. Why do you ask?
Well, unless the defendant attempted to contact every single one-night stand to determine if a child resulted in those unions, he has no parental claim over this child whatsoever. Why now? Why this sperm? And for that matter, all masturbatory emissions where his sperm was clearly not seeking an egg could be termed reckless abandonment.
I believe you've just won your case.
A very good film, and it's obviously endured for a reason, so I thought I'd bring it up.
I definitely haven't seen that film properly because when you described that scene right there, I went, are you taking the piss? Is this the argument that she actually made? And I'm like, so I haven't seen this, so I have to watch it.
I rewatched a couple of films and I watched an awful lot of films for the first time.
Right.
I am debating between one of my rewatches for being my pick,
okay,
or one of my first time watches. But you mentioned earlier the 90s being a high point for these films. And one of the 90s films that I watched for the first time, and I bring it up now because it isn't really a courtroom drama or a courtroom thriller.
Okay.
Because there are no courtroom scenes in it. But it's about lawyers and I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. And it just reinforced my opinion that Tom Cruise, he's always been an excellent movie star. And just recently we had the Golden Globes where Demi Moore was saying that she was disregarded as a popcorn actress. And this Golden Globe she won was the first thing she's ever won for acting. And it staggers me that Tom Cruise has never been awarded by the Academy. Because in the 90s, in his prime era, he was just given these excellent leading man performances. Mm. And one of them is in The Firm.
You think I'm talking about breaking the law?
No, I'm just trying to figure out how far you want it bent.
As far as you can without breaking it.
That firm looks like a health hazard.
That's four dead lawyers.
None of them over the age of 45.
Where are you guys?
The FBI wouldn't have come after you if they didn't think they'd get to you. Now, what do you think made them think that?
I have no idea.
Well, they might know how important your young wife is to you.
Anything's possible. I'll tell you one thing. If those guys at the steak joint were feds, you better watch out for them.
We might be misreading McDear.
You've got nothing to be suspicious about.
I get paid to be suspicious when I got nothing to be suspicious about.
Why are you asking questions about dead lawyers?
What dead lawyers?
I know you'll do your best to protect the firm. Won't you, Mitch?
We have faith that you're going to be with us for a long, long time, Mitch. Fact is, nobody has ever left us. Nobody.
It's a cracker. Like, The Firm is one of those films that I had taped off the TV somehow and watched over and over, and I read the book. I would say it's an action thriller. It's a thriller.
It gets there in the end with the chase scenes, but it's got sort of like Three Days of the Condor, the parallax view kind of, it's got a 70s conspiracy vibe to it, but set within a 90s aesthetic. And oh my God, I was in. And this kind of film now would be a 10 episode series on Apple, and it just wouldn't be the same. And just to have these contained, glossy, smart potboilers that aren't trash, they're really elegant and sophisticated, and just brilliant entertainment.
And you know what this highlights for me as well? It's another topic where we have a slew of great films which wouldn't be great if the writing wasn't top notch.
No.
If the story, they lean so heavily on the story, the structure, the dialogue, the characters. Absolutely, 100%.
Also, there were no weak spots in any of the cast. Every single performance, all the little bit part that day players...
Is this
all
the Firm you're talking about? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, The Firm, but a bunch of these films.
Yeah. Yeah, and back in those days, like the likes of The Firm, that wasn't considered high art. That was just like, it's kind of a popcorn
movie. It is, no.
And I remember at the time, these were just considered, look, Tom Cruise is in this latest action movie, you know, this latest John Grisham. And John Grisham was considered popcorn.
A factory.
Yeah, they were popcorn. It was like, they weren't revered in any way, shape or form. But what, like the way Stephen King wasn't as well. But what they were stories well told. That's why they were so incredibly popular, because his writing and storytelling was economical. It got to the punch, it cut to the chase, it told you a compelling, gripping story. For me, that should be the primary thing, but tell us gripping stories.
For those that don't know what The Firm is about, Tom Cruise has just come out of law school, who hasn't sat the bar yet, and all these different firms are pitching for him to come work for them. And the firm that he chooses seem to have a habit of people within the firm dying under mysterious circumstances. It turns out that he is caught between a rock and a hard place, because the FBI are trying to bust this law firm, and he's going to go down with them unless he provides evidence. And the law firm are suspicious that Tom Cruise could betray them. And he's working with a lot of dangerous, nefarious men. And it's just an excellent little thriller. Really enjoyable. Yeah.
And a lot of the John Grisham stories, if I recall correctly, they don't heavily feature the courtroom drama itself. They're around a crime, around a lawyer, around a journalist. You know, they feature people who are working in the court system as a main protagonist. And as you said, with The Firm, it's not about the actual specific courtroom scene, but it's definitely a courtroom, you know, centric drama for sure.
So you're coming at this topic as a fan of the genre, and I'm coming at it from being freshly exposed to the majority of these films.
Yeah.
And here's another one that I'd seen good chunks of, and I didn't particularly love it. And I was looking at my Letterboxd, and everyone's review was 4 stars, 5 stars, 4.5 stars. I couldn't get up there with them. But it's JFK.
From the shadow of a doubt.
Who would leave a path as big as Lee Harvey Oswald?
To the darkest suspicions.
Nobody's gonna tell me that kid did the shooting job he did from that damn bookstore.
One man would make a dangerous journey.
Don't you think the Kennedy assassination's a little bit out of your domain?
Looking for the truth.
Oswald's been shot!
Kevin Costner in an Oliver Stone film.
Nothing is gonna keep me from my investigation of John Kennedy's murder.
JFK, rated R, starts Friday, December 20th at a theater near you.
Okay. Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Okay.
You put your left leg in.
I watched that a few times during the 90s, but I haven't revisited in a couple of decades. So what were your thoughts? Did you watch it recently, or is this one that, you know, historically you just haven't gotten on with?
Both. Because it's such a long film, it's like over 3 hours long. I'd seen the good guts of it. It was one of those films that an uncle would have watched, and I would have sat down and watched the majority of it and then decided, I can't dedicate 3 hours of my life to this. I'm fucking 10. I want to break windows. So I never really saw
it. I was 11 and I was like going, I want to watch that 3 hour courtroom drama. I am so there for it. There's the difference between you and me. I was so up for it.
With your brandy. See, I didn't, the majority of these films came out when I was well, I've never really grown up. But then you don't really grow up. You never grow up. You just get older. But I was not sitting down to watch, I've got to watch The Accused, lads. Oh, it's a fucking classic. Or hang on a second, though, let me watch JFK. I let those films go by. They weren't for me. I wasn't the target audience. I wanted to watch fucking Batman Returns or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, the film is very much a product of its time. And it seems now, in this era where everything is a conspiracy, they're in the States and they're calling pasteurized milk a fucking deep state conspiracy. Cloud seeding. Fucking, it's horrible. You don't know what's real, what's not. It's bots, it's this. And JFK feels like catnip for that audience.
Hmm.
First of all, I don't believe that Lee Harvey Oswald killed that man. I think he was a patsy. I think there was a bigger conspiracy there. But I don't buy into the argument made by Oliver Stone in this film. And the film itself is frantic. From the first scene all the way through to the end is just a series of revolving rants from different characters. They each take a scene to grandstand. The whole film feels like horseshit or really thinly strung together separate coincidences into a huge conspiracy that proves that JFK was murdered by a patsy that was set up and the Israelis were involved and all this kind of shite. I'm sure there's a grain of truth to a lot of it, but where we are in this world where fascism is on the rise and the jingoism and the, like, I was trying to hold on my sick where Kevin Costner's like watching JFK get shot and he's in a cafe and he's saying, for the first time in my life, I'm ashamed to be an American. And it's so earnest and it's so like, this is the greatest country on earth. And if we don't stand up to this and that, and I'm like, well, you fucking failed there then. You've now got that buffoon in the White House. So 3 stars for me. It wore out its welcome. It's nothing but ranting. That film grated on me. So I say all that while holding my hands up and going, incredible writing. Kevin Costner is amazing. Every actor that shows up in it, like, it's fucking wall to wall. There must be 50 movie stars in it. They all get their moments. But where we are in the world with politics and all that kind of stuff, and this rah-rah, America is amazing type of energy behind it, it bothered me. So it felt like it was written by a fucking crazy person.
Can I take you back to young me who was eagerly waiting to grab the video box because I wouldn't have been allowed to go see it in the cinema. And I remember getting my VHS copy of it from the video library, going home. And my impression, I can give you my impression of it back in the 90s. It felt like it was the dangerous movie. It felt like Oliver Stone was going to be assassinated just for making this film. That they were trying to, and somehow I had gotten my hands on the secret files. And I was
taking
the secret
files. It feels now like a TikTok video of a person just ranting.
Yeah. And I remember one of the things that stands out to me right now was I remember watching it and noticing the pan and scan of it, because I was watching a pan and scan version.
Oh, yeah.
And going, so that would have made it even harder to watch because I remember feeling like, oh, I kind of wanted to see the widescreen version of this because it just, you know, I can see the, you know, this pan and scan going on. I remember at the end of it feeling like, you know, he has it. He has, you know, the answer is out there. The secret is out there. They're just keeping it all. It's all a conspiracy. It's all been hidden. But eventually,
there is definitely a conspiracy involved. There's definitely, but this is the thing. There's a grain of truth to most conspiracies. But this feels no more convincing to me than them saying Capricorn 1 is based in fact.
Yeah.
But we never went to the moon, lads. It was a fucking set. Stanley Kubrick came in and he filmed it on a soundstage. Look at them. They're bouncing about. That doesn't look like the moon. You don't walk like that in the moon.
And as a film,
to the left.
As a film, I remember not being blown away. I was blown away by the fact that I was reading a secret. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. But as if I was seeing these secret files. Like, it was like, I'm watching a dramatization of a documentary or something like that. Not that I was watching a film that I was gripped by or thrilled by, and a story, a yarn that was being told to me that excited me and whatnot. It wasn't a John Grisham type story. That was what I'm saying.
Saying all that, the courtroom scene where Kevin Costner makes his final plea is excellent.
So now a single bullet remains. A single bullet now has to account for the remaining seven wounds in Kennedy and Conley. But rather than admit to a conspiracy or investigate further, the Warren Commission chose to endorse the theory put forth by an ambitious junior counselor, Arlen Specter, one of the grossest lies ever forced on the American people. We've come to know it as the magic bullet theory. The magic bullet enters the president's back, headed downward at an angle of 17 degrees. It then moves upward in order to leave Kennedy's body from the front of his neck. Wound number two, where it waits 1.6 seconds, presumably in midair, where it turns right, then left, and continues into Conley's body at the rear of his right armpit. Wound number three. The bullet then heads downward at an angle of 27 degrees, shattering Conley's fifth rib and exiting from the right side of his chest. Wound number four. The bullet then turns right and re-enters Conley's body at his right wrist. Wound number five. Shattering the radius bone, the bullet then exits Conley's wrist. Wound number six. Makes a dramatic U-turn and buries itself into Conley's left thigh. Wound number seven, from which it later falls out and is found in almost pristine condition on a stretcher in a corridor of Parkland Hospital. That's some bullet.
But yeah, it's just I'm coming to it now with too much prejudice where it's like, fuck off with your rah-rah America this, America that, especially where we are today. And it just felt very dated.
Shut up, bitch!
Too much. It all felt like Charlie Day with the drawing the red lines. It's all connected.
It's all connected, it is, lads. That. Jesus Christ.
It is that. And you know what? One thing it does actually highlight to me is Kevin Costner hasn't done many courtroom dramas, if any, outside of JFK. And I think he would be a brilliant lawyer. I think he would, he's got that Gregory Peck quality to him where he could sell a convincing...
Pure Americana.
Yeah, Americana. He could sell a convincing argument.
Also, he's got a great name.
Who? Pure Americana? I don't know who you're referring to. But yeah,
Think about it.
Who? Kevin Costner? He's got a great name.
Yeah.
Kevin Costner's got a great name.
Yeah.
I have to do a meme of, you have to explain the joke to me now. You have to really explain the joke to me.
What's my name?
Oh, for fuck's sake. Your name isn't Kevin Costner.
My name is Kevin Will. And he's a Kevin. Do you know what? And I mean this sincerely.
Yeah.
As a writer, you're always going through your Rolodex of names. And I cannot ever reuse a name if I've used them before, even if it's a side character. There's too much baggage with them. So once I've gone through a name, I'm now down to fucking F-list names.
You're just using numbers. Z9534.
Fat man number four. I'd love to write a character called Kevin, but I can't because that's my name.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's such a solid boy's name.
Yeah. It's so hard. It's so hard to get it in there.
Life is hard.
You're talking about names. Can I tell you a quick side anecdote, right? Of, I think the first time I came up to a wedding on Karen's side of the family and meeting her extended family at this cousin's wedding. And
Karen, have you met Darren? This is Sharon.
But Karen's mother was introducing me to someone, like, you know, an auntie or something like that. And she said, "Oh, Deirdre, this is Will." And Karen was there as well, or you could see her just going, "This is Will." She just said quietly, "Smith." Getting jiggy with it. This is Will.
I remember working in a call center. Oh, I wasn't a call center. I was working on the reservations desk for, oh my God, I can't remember what company it is now. This is definitely getting cut because this emasculates me.
Yeah.
But it was like Ticketmaster. People would book for concerts and for hotels and things like that. What was that job? Fucking hell, I've worked so many jobs, I can't remember it.
Rent boy, that's what it was.
Do you think I could be a rent boy? That's very flattering. Thanks, Will.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. There's a customer for everyone.
Dollar a go. 1 euro, right.
Yeah.
And you pick up the phone, you go, "Hello, this is Kevin." And the woman on the other end of the line goes, "Hello, Helen, this is..." And for the rest of the call, I was like, what did she fucking say? What did you say? She said, Helen. And then I was like, oh yeah, I'll sort that out there for you. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
You're having a great laugh off that. Stop laughing because then I'll be forced to include it.
Oh, God.
That rattled me. I couldn't. I was then practicing. I was practicing going like, how did I say that? How did I, did what? I didn't think I said that. Like, how are you, love? This is Helen. I just answered the phone normally. And maybe she didn't say that. Maybe I just misheard her. But I was like, she just called me Helen.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
Anyway. Oh, God. It's like that time over the summer where Luke was one of the trainers. Luke was at a football camp. And one of the I told you this. One of the coaches said, Luke.
On a mini bits.
It was on a mini bits. And one of the coaches pointed at Luke as in, you got to pass the ball to Luke over there. And Luke thought he was referring to the fact that Luke was wearing a bib. Like, you know, he thought he was the bib teams. And he says, and Luke says, oh, you got to pass to, and he like gestured for Luke to give him his name. But Luke thought he meant one of the teams that were wearing bibs. And he went, a bib? And your coach thought his name was a bib for the rest of the week. And anytime I hear about Karen asked me to pass her a bib for Chloe, I start laughing. You know, it's like, will you pass me a bib? And I just go, oh, Luke, a bib.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Right, back on topic. Okay. What were we talking about? Oh, JFK. You were talking about JFK.
Three stars up.
Three stars. Okay. You briefly mentioned it, and it's definitely on my list because it was one of those serious films that I watched when I was young. It came out in 1993 and it was Philadelphia, of course.
Highline Incorporated is now represented by Wyant, Wheeler, Hellman, Tetlow, and Brown. And more specifically, Andrew Beckett.
Yes! Bravo!
I sincerely appreciate your faith in my abilities.
Mr. Beckett!
How are you? What happened to your face?
I have AIDS. Seeking representation.
You want to sue Wyant, Wheeler, Hellman, Tetlow, and Brown?
I was diagnosed with AIDS 8 months ago during a bout with pneumonia.
What's that in your forehead, pal?
Andy, everyone in this room is your friend.
I misplaced an important complaint. That's their story.
We've been talking it over. Your future, that is. And we feel that because we respect you so much, we must be honest with you.
Excuse me. Am I being fired?
Would you accept a client if you were constantly thinking, I don't want this person to touch me?
I have a case.
I don't want them to even breathe on me.
You don't want it for personal reasons.
Thank you. That's correct. I don't.
That's very disappointing.
Sir, wouldn't you be more comfortable in a research room?
No. Would it make you more comfortable?
Beckett, how you doing?
Counselor.
Did you find a lawyer?
There's going to be things said at the trial that are going to be hard for you to hear.
I want to know everything about his personal life. What deviant groups did he secretly belong to?
I didn't raise my kids to sit in the back of the bus.
Is Andrew Beckett the kind of lawyer who misplaces crucial documents?
An excellent lawyer.
Andrew Beckett is dying.
You were impressed with Andrew Beckett's work.
Andrew Beckett is angry.
What powerful force has caused him to change his mind?
And he wants someone to pay.
TriStar Pictures presents...
The law's been broken.
I just want what is fair, what is right.
You remember the law, don't you?
A Jonathan Demme picture.
So let's talk about what this case is really all about.
Did you fire Andrew Beckett because he had AIDS?
The general public's hatred, our loathing, our fear.
In this courtroom, Mr. Miller, justice is blind to matters of sexual orientation.
We don't live in this courtroom, no, do we?
Tom Hanks.
I love the law.
Denzel Washington.
Are you gay?
Objection!
In a story about our lives.
Oh, Mom, today's a good day.
Our fears.
Andy brought AIDS into our offices.
And our humanity.
I hate this case.
Fear.
Philadelphia.
How many lawyers you go to before you call me?
9.
I remember seeing that so many times, and I thought it was...
great song.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. But I believe the 1990s are to blame for a lot of...
AIDS.
Shitty courtroom shenanigans in real life in America.
If the gloves don't fit, you must acquit.
Stuff like when we see people coming in wheelchairs, it's like Harvey Weinstein coming into wheelchair, people who are complete villains being wheeled in, made to look victims. Michael Jackson, you know, stumbling or being wheeled into his trials. The dude from The Jinx coming in, making him look as frail as possible. I think the 90s is to blame for that kind of tactic by defense lawyers.
Not courtroom TV?
No, I think it's specifically 90s, because good films like Philadelphia, in Philadelphia, the best scene for me is a really fucking powerful scene where, for those of you, because maybe some people don't actually know what Philadelphia is about, Tom Hanks stars as a fired hotshot a lawyer who has been fired because he has AIDS, and also he's revealed that he's, as a consequence, is gay. And that's the reason he was fired. So Tom Hanks is dying of AIDS, and he's going around looking for a defense attorney. He can't get anyone to pick up his case, and eventually he finds Denzel Washington, who at his core is a homophobe, right? And it is a story of the case of him trying to take his former employers to court. And ultimately, you know, there's an arc in it. There's an arc in it for Denzel Washington, definitely, where he goes from a homophobe to someone who's compassionate and understanding. But it's a really moving film. It really is. And I think Tom Hanks absolutely deserved his Academy Award for that. He lost a couple of stone for it, and he's really frail looking, and it's really, really, really powerful. It's like Tom Hanks we've never seen before.
It was very, not just controversial, but it was a trailblazing film at the time.
Listen, I think this is a wonderful film, right? I feel it's one of those films that it's got amazing performances, it's really well made, it's really well shot, really well crafted and beautifully made. But my point is that in my best scene from that film, and the scene, and it's an amazing scene where Tom Hanks takes the stand and he's cross-examined by the prosecution and the defense. He's really fucking frail. But Denzel Washington's knockout punch in that scene is he goes up to Tom Hanks, who's incredibly frail, with a mirror. And he said, did they know you had AIDS at the time they fired you? And he said, they had to have known.
May I borrow your mirror, please? Andrew. Do you have any lesions on any part of your body at this time that resemble the lesions you had on your face at the time that you were fired?
Yes. On my torso.
Your torso. If it please the court, I would like to ask Andrew to remove his shirt so that, you know, everyone here could get an accurate idea of what we're talking about.
Objection, Your Honor. It would unfairly influence the jury.
Your Honor, if Andrew was forced to use a wheelchair due to his illness, would the defense ask him to park it outside because it would unfairly influence the jury? Come on, we're talking about AIDS. We're talking about lesions. Let's see what we're talking about.
I'll allow it. Mr. Beckett, would you please remove your shirt?
And Tom Hanks slowly unbuttons his shirt, exposing himself. And it's like a Jesus Christ moment where he's showing his ravaged body. And we see this just almost a scar of lesions across his body. And Denzel Washington just holds up the mirror. And everyone in the entire courtroom can clearly see it. It is shocked. It's really shocking. And everyone's just like hit in the stomach. And he holds up the mirror and he says, can you see those lesions on your body? And Tom Hanks says yes. He says, that's my case. Because, yeah, you can fucking see it. Everyone can fucking see him. So you're talking shit. It's really powerful. It's a knockout punch in the movie. Because what Denzel Washington has done as an attorney, he has emotionally won over the jury. He's elicited their sympathy. He's pulled on the sympathy string. It works for that movie. But I think the problem is that so many real-life defense attorneys have gone and said, right, we got to win over the jury, so we need to play the sympathy card. And they reference things like Philadelphia as, you know, see, in Philadelphia, it really works in that moment. But the problem is, in Philadelphia, it's Philadelphia.
A movie.
It's a movie, and also it's about an addressing a societal imbalance. And really bringing that hot topic at the time to the fore and kind of shining a light on it and saying, look at what injustice has been done upon this minority of people simply because they are the way they are. And in those cases, it works. But then those tactics get borrowed by real life lawyers. So I think that Hollywood has kind of negatively impacted the judicial system when those type of cases or those type of tactics are used in the real world. But I think it is a fantastic film. I love that scene. It gets me every time. And that song is amazing.
Absolutely. I didn't revisit it for this because I saw it in the 90s and I have a clear memory of it. But yeah, I think he deserved the Oscar for that film more than for Forrest Gump.
Wow, man, you just ran through a big pile of dog shit.
It happens.
What, shit?
Sometimes.
Right, I'm going to rattle through now some other films that I saw, Will, for this topic and give you my take on it and chime in where you feel necessary. These aren't my top films, but the films that I really enjoyed to rewatch for this. I watched Judgment at Nuremberg.
The principle of criminal law in every civilized society has this in common. Any person who sways another to commit murder, any person who furnishes the lethal weapon for the purpose of the crime, any person who is an accessory to the crime, is guilty.
There's some great performances in that. Burt Lancaster is one of these Nazis who's put on trial, and Spencer Tracy is one of the judges. It's the Nuremberg trials, essentially, just dramatized. And after World War II, they're coming to terms with who was complicit, who was following orders, and who's guilty in that respect. So these judges are on trial with these other judges, these American military judges. William Shatner's in there as one of his early films. Spencer Tracy has a fantastic speech at the end.
A decision must be made in the life of every nation at the very moment when the grasp of the enemy is at his throat. Then it seems that the only way to survive is to use the means of the enemy, to rest survival upon what is expedient, to look the other way. Well, the answer to that is survival as what? A country isn't a rock. It's not an extension of oneself. It's what it stands for. It's what it stands for when standing for something is the most difficult. Before the people of the world, let it now be noted that here in our decision, this is what we stand for. Justice, truth, and the value of a single human being.
A film that feels like it was very important at the time, and there's a gravitas to these people coming to terms with revenge, justice, and navigating the future. How do we put the past behind us? How do we work with people who have committed atrocities? What does the future look like? What is cooperation going forward? Do we leave the past in the past? And they're really grappling with it. And it's a very adult film, but it also feels in some respects, well, it was necessary at the time that where we are in the world right now, where we're sliding back, and people are proudly adopting the far right beliefs, it feels like we've lost so much of the evolved mindset that we had. And it's probably even more necessary to rewatch films like this because history looks like it could easily repeat itself. And we've already settled those arguments and we're back there again. So it rattled me a little, that film, but great final few moments where they are summing up the importance of the future versus the crimes of the past.
Yeah.
Great performances. Other films I watched, Witness for the Prosecution, a great lark of a film.
Mm-hmm.
You told them that he was at home with you at 25 minutes past nine, and now you say that that was a lie.
Yes, a lie.
And when you said that he had accidentally cut his wrist, again you lied?
Yes.
And now today you've told us a new story entirely. The question is, Frau Helm, were you lying then? Are you lying now? Or are you not, in fact, a chronic and habitual liar?
Charles Laughton, who directed a fantastic Night of the Hunter. In this, he is the lead character. Billy Wilder film, so you know what you're getting with a Billy Wilder film. Great dialogue, great moments, lots of rat-a-tat dialogue. But he is an ailing barrister who should be taking it easy, and he's brought in to defend a friend of a friend who is on trial for murder, and he doesn't know whether he can trust his defendant or not. Lovely film, like one of those matinee Sunday films, just bounces along.
That's exactly when you should watch it. It's just Sunday afternoon matinee movie. Perfect. Perfect time for that film.
And then a film that blew me away. I was kind of aware that there was a twist in it. I didn't know what the specifics were, the twist. I was more exposed to this film by the Empire pieces that would be on it. It made a star out of Edward Norton, but I just saw it for the first time, and that's Primal Fear.
On my first day of law school, my professor says from this day forward, your mother says she loves you, get a second opinion.
In the game called fame,
you are a master at putting the victim on trial.
A victim in this case is my client.
In the business called justice,
first thing I ask a new client is, so you've been saving up for a rainy day? Guess what? It's raining.
The victim in this case is not only the Archbishop, it's also the people of Chicago.
Excuse me.
Law offices in Martinvale.
You got the news on by any chance? I think everyone's going to want this one.
There's one lawyer they love to hate.
Sell the book rights yet, or are you going to wait a while?
Now tell me, counselor, which one of us is the true headline chaser here?
Unlike you, I was assigned to this case.
You know who I am?
No, sir, I don't.
Don't you read the papers?
I'm like going, I can't believe this is your first time watching that film. I remember.
I've got more that will shock you.
And well, I just want to say at the time, and again, this is going back to a point I made earlier on, this was just one of those kind of popcorn-y, you know, populist culture movies.
Now it looks like a masterpiece.
There you go. Yeah, now it's aged so well. But I think there's a lesson to be learned. And the lesson is like, you know, it films take time for them to truly mature, or the audience to actually appreciate how good they are and how well crafted they are. And at the time, it's just like, ah, yeah, whatever. Like,
it's because we've denigrated and we have changed the way that we make films, and we just don't make them as well as we used to.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
they now make massive big blockbusters which have to cater for everybody, and you have these rare outliers like Nolan or Denis Villeneuve. But like, I was even looking at the filmographies of some of these filmmakers, and they're banging up films every 18 months. It was like one after the other, after the other, after the other. Now, if you are a hotshot filmmaker, unless you are Nolan, unless you are Denis Villeneuve, they're going 4 or 5 years between films. So rather than having a run of films like Sidney Lumet or Polanski or Donner or fucking
Rob Reiner,
where you're doing 8, 9, 10 films in a decade, now they might do 2 films in a decade.
Yeah.
And that is a terrible indictment to how gummed up the system is and how shit films have become, not just in their pre-production, but in their need to be the biggest possible film for everybody. Mm. Or they're independent films which take fucking forever to get made.
Because financing.
Financing. Yeah. It's gotten ridiculous now where you turn on a film and you've got 15, 20 production logos at the start, where it's just this one and that one and this one and that one, because they're just robbing from Peter to pay Paul to get enough foreign money to make a film.
And it's just gotten worse. Even in recent years, it's gotten way worse.
Another film I watched that I didn't particularly like as much, but I had to watch it because it's an important film. And again, it's one of those films where we've gotten to in the world feels like we're sliding backwards. And this is another film which brings into stark contrast where we were and where we are. And all the ground that we gained, we're losing. And that's The Accused.
Oh, God, so
The Accused,
yeah.
Is Jodie Foster is raped by a bunch of guys in a rundown dive bar.
Yeah.
And Kelly McGillis is her prosecutor.
How are you dressed? What's that supposed to mean?
It means were you dressed provocatively? Showing a lot of cleavage, see-through blouse?
What the fuck difference does it matter how I was dressed? They tore it off of me.
But did how you dress make those guys think that they could have sex with you? Did you put on a show?
What the hell are you talking about? You saw me at the hospital. What do you think I asked for that? Is that what you think? If that's what you think, you get the fuck out of my house.
Have you ever made love to more than one man at a time?
What the fuck kind of question is that?
It's the kind of question you're going to be asked on the stand. You're also going to be asked if Larry or any other man has ever hit you, and if you liked it. You're going to be asked about your drug bust and how many drinks a day you have to smooth out the edges and how many joints and how often you go to bars alone and whether or not you wear underwear when you go to them and which diseases you've caught and how many abortions you've had. And I will object to all those questions. And sometimes the judge will sustain me, but sometimes not.
That ain't fair.
Sarah, you're a witness. And it's the defense's job to show the jury that you're a rotten witness because you've got a rotten character.
I got a rotten character? You ain't gonna defend me because I'm some low-class bimbo, right?
I didn't say that.
It's quite dated in its filmmaking, but I was more struck by the arguments that they were having that felt like settled law, and yet we're still at a place where a lot of the rights that women have had given to them are now being eroded and taken away, especially in the States. So that was a bit of a bummer. But I didn't love it as much as some of the other films.
No, it's not. It's not. And I think Jodie Foster might. There was a few Oscar nominations.
She won an Academy Award for that. Well.
Did she win it? Okay, very good. Yeah.
She feels miscast to me, funnily enough.
Do you know what it is, though? It still is a rock solid film. It's still one of those films that, you know.
I thought you were going to say a romp.
No, it's not a romp. It's one of those films that is just like, oh, I'm glad I watched it. I was, wouldn't say entertained, but it scratched an itch for me, for sure. What other ones are on your list? Can I do a little sidebar? A little teeny, teeny, tiny little sidebar, right?
I also watched Anatomy of a Murder and I thought that was great. Good film. Sorry.
Very good. Teeny, tiny little sidebar is what I feel has happened to the courtroom drama in recent years is, you know, we've had the Netflixification of those types of stories, or where we have the really compelling documentary series, like, you know, the breakout one, Making a Murderer, which was, season one was absolutely amazing. But also the one I really want to highlight for one of the best courtroom stories I've ever seen.
The Jinx?
The Jinx was really good, but also, primarily I'm highlighting the Staircase, the actual documentary, documentary. The Staircase, which was adapted, which I actually thought the adaptation was actually really good as well. But the original documentary was amazing because you are there for the whole trial. The documentary is filmed by a son's friend. So you're in the house with the family. He initially came to, I think the son was a film student or whatever it was, and just kind of said, oh, I'm going to just shoot this thing, you know, as a project. And he became a part of the family and had real intimate access. And it is absolutely riveting. One of the best courtroom dramas I've ever experienced. And the thing about it is it's real life.
I can vividly remember finding Kathleen.
911, where's your emergency?
My wife's had an accident. She's still breathing.
What kind of accident?
Still downstairs.
I think the original one was, 2004. The original series came out in 2004.
But it's like these days, they're becoming TV shows like Presumed Innocent. Used to be a film.
Yeah.
No, it's a 10-episode series that I didn't particularly enjoy. Felt very drawn out, whereas the film felt much more direct.
This summer, only one movie is utterly absorbing.
Carolyn Paul Amos was murdered last night.
Gripping. A real sizzler.
You think I killed her?
Riveting. A first-rate thriller. Sensational. A knockout. Powerful. Spellbinding. A heart pounder. It keeps you breathless.
How can you think that I could do a thing like that?
Harrison Ford. Presumed Innocent. Rated R. Starts Friday, July 27th at a theater near you.
Right, I only have two to go, Will.
Okay, let me see here.
And I've been juggling between the two of them because one is a film that I rewatched and one is a film that I saw for the first time.
Okay.
And both of them are perfect films.
Okay, I wonder, do we overlap? Okay, I've one, two, three.
If we do, we do.
Oh, there's actually, I've got three films to mention. I know we overlap, so I wonder which ones. I don't know where you're going to go, you see.
Sustained.
Since we're talking about real life documentaries, there was also a very compelling documentary from 2003, which actually is devastating, about a real life crime court case. Well, it's a crime called Capturing the Freedmans, which I remember seeing at a festival.
Do you know, I've never seen it.
It's devastating is what it is. It's devastating. It's
not funny.
Not as entertaining. It's not funny. It's not like the Staircase where it's riveting, where you kind of don't know which way is going to go. This is very much, you know, a young person dealing with the trauma of something that's happened awful in their family. And he's used a camera, has documented everything from the 1980s on up. So it's just, it's kind of really interesting when you actually have that intimate home video footage to you know, to tell this awful story about these awful crimes that were done. Still, it was riveting, I would say.
And is there courtroom scenes?
See, this is what I'm trying to recall. I think it's like you've got the before and after.
Because that's the weird thing about American courts. Especially, I know it's state-specific and New York doesn't allow it, but if there are federal cases, they don't allow it. But if you commit a murder and you're in California, you're going to be on TV.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Courtroom TV.
The other one I have to bring up as well, as just as I get these ones, the kind of TV'd ones or documentary type ones, is the limited series OJ Made in America, which is a phenomenal TV series. And you do get the courtroom, the whole, all that courtroom drama, which the entire world, it felt like, was focused on. Definitely the entirety of America was focused on.
There was a documentary and then there was a dramatization.
Dramatization. I'm talking about the documentary. The documentary was phenomenal.
Do you think he did it?
It's not when you watch it. What's amazing about that OJ series, after the first episode, I remember feeling, I don't care if he did it. I love this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, he might have made a mistake at one stage.
They do a great thing of showing you the fall of him. But when you get to the actual crime,
yes,
and you see the state that he left her in, he almost beheaded her.
Yeah. He was a cold psychopath.
He was a monster, an absolute monster. And the trivialization of that trial is a terrible crime against the families.
Yeah.
But that was brilliant. Those things, the dramatization was great crack and the documentary series was superb.
Yeah.
Right, Will.
Yes.
I have two films.
Okay.
And I'm going to go with my runner-up pick as the one I've rewatched.
So if it's your runner-up, I'm wondering how I do my... I have three films to bring up. So I think we're overlapping.
Well, go with your third one.
Okay, my third one is A Few Good Men.
No, don't do that. No, don't do that now.
Okay. My third one is My Cousin Vinny.
That's my runner-up. What the fuck is your third one?
My number one. My number one is my main one. It's on your list.
Okay, right. Well, I'll tell you then. I rewatched My Cousin Vinny. I adore that film. I've spoken to you in the past that Dale Lawner is one of my favorite writers. Even though it's hard to really judge a writer's career because they get rewritten and they get chewed up by the Hollywood system, the majority of a writer's career is spent in development rather than in production. But the films that Dale Lawner made, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Rootless People, My Cousin Vinny, they're my favorite kind of comedy. They are character-driven, but they've got great banter, great set pieces, and just really strong premises. And My Cousin Vinny is such a perfect crowd pleaser.
A funny thing happened to William and Stanley on their way to college.
At what point did you shoot the clerk?
They got framed for murder.
Whoa! Wait a minute!
Now, two kids from New York are in deep trouble.
It's time to make your phone calls.
The Clans here, they're inbred, they sleep with their sisters.
In the deep South.
Some of them do.
And only one man can save them.
We need to call an attorney, a great attorney.
He's not your typical hero.
We got an attorney in the family.
Great, who?
He's...
My Cousin Vinny.
You stick out like a sore thumb around here.
Oh, yeah, you blend.
You graduated from law school 6 years ago. What have you been doing since?
Studying for the bar. That's a lot of studying.
What's this over here?
You never heard of grits?
Sure. I just actually never seen a grit before.
It's his first case.
Now, didn't I tell you to dress appropriately?
You were serious about that?
The way you handled that judge. Oh, you're a smooth talker. You are.
It's their last chance.
The two utes.
Did you say utes?
Yeah, two utes.
What is a ute?
But with Vinny's style...
I wore this ridiculous thing for you.
And Vinny's girlfriend...
We agreed to get married as soon as you won your first case. My biological clock is ticking like this. And the way this case is going, I ain't never getting married.
They're dead meat.
May I have permission to treat Ms. Beetle as a hostile witness?
You think I'm hostile? Now wait till you see me tonight.
Joe Pesci is My Cousin Vinny.
You two know each other?
Yeah, she's my fiancée.
Well, that would certainly explain the hostility.
I rewatched it last night. I was not going to rewatch it because I've seen it before so many times, but I'm glad I did rewatch it because in context of watching all these other courtroom films, this is such a joy of a film. And it's one other thing I want to mention because it stood out to me at the end. My God, I miss when we had end credit songs.
I literally should.
My cousin Vinny has got a great end credit song.
It details the entire plot of the film. Well, it was a New York attorney about to take a southern journey into places that he'd never been.
She was a brunette out of Brooklyn, fast talking and good looking with a body that was made for sin. And it's a cover
version. He was a lawyer down in Georgia.
They rewrote the lyrics of the film. But My Cousin Vinny, if you've not seen it, you probably have. I mean,
if not, do watch it.
Often on TV. Do watch it. But the Karate Kid, Ralph Macchio, gets accused of being involved in a stick-up in a convenience store. And as I was saying to you earlier on, the films of that era were populated with fantastic character actors. All had great moments. And My Cousin Vinny is just full of them. From the defense lawyer to the lawyer that comes in to represent the other guy that's accused, to the judge, to the people in the bars, where he has this running joke where one of the guys has swindled $200 off Marissa Tomei and he agrees to fight him if he can prove that he has the $200. And the guy just wants to fight him, but he can't until he has proof he's got the $200. These lovely little side moments. But it's a fish out of water tale of Joe Pesci, who comes to represent his nephew and his best friend, who are innocent and are being tried for murder. And he's never been in a courtroom before. He has no experience, but he feels he can do this and he just needs that shot. And my two films, vacillate in between which one was going to be my pick. They both feel like sports films. They both feel like underdogs going up against the Premier League side, and it has that same rousing energy of like a Rocky film or something, where you're leaning in and going like, just get it, you can do it. My Cousin Vinny is just a gorgeous comedy. Great performances from all the cast. The judge is phenomenal. Marissa Tomei 100% deserved the Oscar, and I know she got a lot of stick where people thought she didn't deserve it because she's giving a comedic performance, but in the supporting roles, that's where the comedians tend to win. I love the film.
Before we were getting online, I actually rewatched that the moment in the Oscars where she won her Academy Award. And it's funny because the other actresses who were in the category, they were all English actresses.
There's one thing I forgot to mention, and that is that this is one of the few times in the history of Academy Awards that five foreign actresses were up for the same award, four English and one from Brooklyn. And the Oscar goes to Marissa.
And you cut to Marissa Tomei's clip.
My biological clock is ticking.
It's ticking, and that's what it is. She's stamping her foot. You know, the urban myth was Jack Palance misread her name on the card. But clearly that wasn't the fucking case.
No, she's great at it.
Kind of precipitated this idea. Ah, you're nothing. The people associated the character she plays with the actor herself. I love My Cousin Vinny. It's one of those films that I was referring to earlier on, that I saw twice in the cinema, twice in the cozy cinema in Kentork, and I can put myself in the seat where I was sitting when I watched that film. And it wasn't as if at the time this was like, oh, this is the best film I've ever seen. It just felt like a normal film. It was felt like, this is the type of film I expect. Yes, now as time has gone on, I've realized, no, do you know what? Jesus Christ, how well written, well performed, just generally the level of quality around the filmmaking was
excellent.
Higher than what we expect now. The knockout punch in the film is Marissa Tomei's testimony.
Your Honor, the defense calls as its first witness Ms. Mona Lisa Vitale.
Oh, I object, Your Honor. This person's not on the witness list.
This witness is an expert in the field of automobiles and is being called to rebut the testimony of George Wilbur. Your Honor, would you please instruct the bailiff
Officer.
To escort Ms. Vitale to the witness stand, please?
She's being dismissed throughout the film, and she's bothering Joe Pesci, and they have a falling out, and everything depends on her at that stage. She can save the lives. It's a lovely courtship where you can see that they're falling back in love with each other through the cross-examination.
Joe Pesci's such a hunk as well.
I love the moment where he goes like, watch this. And he kicks back and it's like he's so proud of her.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And what I love about it, as opposed to, let's say, that brilliant scene in Philadelphia, for instance, you know, where he's winning over the hearts of the jury. Joe Pesci is winning over the minds. He's going, hang on a second. Look at this fact. Look at the absolute brilliance and, you know, encyclopedic knowledge that my girlfriend has. And what's delightful in the scene is when the prosecuting lawyer tries to get a number on her. He says, oh, can you tell me the turnover, you know, time of a whatever it is engine? And she goes, I can't answer the question.
It's a trick question. You
know, it's a trick question. And then she just fucking nails him, saying it couldn't have been that car because it wasn't released at that time. It's brilliant.
It's a bullshit question. It's impossible to answer.
Impossible because you don't know the answer.
Nobody could answer that question.
Your Honor, I move to disqualify Ms. Vito as an expert witness.
Can you answer the question?
No, it is a trick question.
Why is it a trick question?
Watch this.
Because Chevy didn't make a 327 in 55. The 327 didn't come out till 62. And it wasn't offered in the Bel Air with a four-barrel carb till 64. However, in 1964, the correct ignition timing would be 4 degrees before top dead center.
Well,
great little character moments.
She's acceptable.
It's definitely a comedy. It's an out-and-out comedy, but it's just a beautifully constructed one where it's all character all the time. And I fucking love it. But that scene is a standout moment, and it's a crowd-pleasing moment, and I love crowd-pleasers.
Mm. The judge, by the way, the guy, the actor who played the judge, whose name escapes me right now, that was his
Pet
final
Cemetery.
That was his final film.
Oh God, I was watching it and thinking, we've lost a quality of character actor like that. These types, these people who they fit into certain roles, they're not perfect for them, and they nail every moment. So there's a great running joke where Joe Pesci, I can't say his surname, one of the wet bandits, he is turning up to court. He's turning up to court. Judicial process. He's turning up to court in like a leather jacket, and the judge is like chastising him and holding him in contempt of court. And he keeps getting thrown in jail and having to ride the prison bus back with the two kids that he's defending. They're like looking at this like, he's representing us, this guy. But yeah, rewatching it again, it's reminded me of what a great film it is, but also what a fucking joy-filled film it is. And I was saying to a friend of mine, this is one of these films where the direction is perfect. The camera is never in the wrong place. It's got a great music, it's got great scenes, great writing, great performances. It's a warm blanket of a film, and you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone that dislikes it, I would imagine.
And another thing, it's a film which is actually shown to students as an example of how, you know, I think impressively, the film actually sticks very close to how judicial practice actually is in real life as well, or the American system.
Really? Because I thought it was a lot of bollocks.
No, it's actually because I think the director actually, the director, I'm pretty sure, is a law graduate. And so it actually does stick to, stick to actual legal procedure quite well.
For me, this is on the same level of Midnight Run. It's that kind of comfort movie.
Mm-hmm. Only niggle about it, and I love this film, is I think the Ralph Macchio and his friend's storyline, whenever we cut to them, it gets a little bit flat.
Oh, I don't agree.
Do you think so? That's the one side where I'm like going, you know, it's a little bit flat there, but
no, I think
it's just a delight.
You don't want anything bad to happen to them.
Yeah, that's fine. The rest of the film is working on a level that's A++++, and Ralph Macchio and his buddy story is just a little bit just.
I'm going to change my Letterboxd review now because you said that. I'm going to change it from 4.5 stars to 5. Fuck you.
Fine. That's fine. That's fine. That's fine. It's a great
And bit. I'm going to like
that's
it as well. Yes. Got to be a fan. Well, I'm so shocked. I don't know how this episode is going to cut together in the edit because I don't know whether you've blown my cover or not.
I don't know which way you're going. I don't know.
Well, I've only got one left.
Shit. There's two films that are on my list that we haven't discussed, or maybe we have. But there's one we definitely haven't discussed. So I'll do my pick, right? And I think my other runner-up.
Yeah, you have to, because it's my episode. Remember,
I know.
Here.
I'm just trying to... So my runner-up... Episode. You can correct me. You can actually redirect me. So my pick is kind of the best courtroom drama movie that's not set in a courtroom.
So what are we doing here? The topic is courtroom dramas.
But this is just off to the side.
Oh, is this going to be like fucking Schindler's List?
It's 12 Angry Men. It's 12 Angry Men.
Oh, how have we not spoken about that? How has that not come up?
Yeah.
How has that not come up? That's a 5-star film for me.
On the point of that knife, a man's life is at stake.
I'm just saying it's possible.
And I say it's not possible.
I want you to watch this because I don't want to have to do it again. I'll make myself about 6 or 7 inches shorter, okay?
It's about right, maybe a little more.
Okay, a little more.
It's a 5-star film, and I just went, oh, I thought it was... It's a basic choice, but after rewatching, because I've watched it several times throughout the years, and I've rewatched clips, you know, to try and get my thoughts together on this
film. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because it's in my list, and I would have demanded we got back on mic and spoken about it, because I just rewatched it again just a couple of days ago, and boy, what a faultless film.
Here's what I think happened.
How can we be positive about anything?
I don't understand you people. I mean, all these picky little points you keep bringing up, they don't mean nothing.
You are going to try a man for murder. The awesome power to kill will suddenly be thrust into your hand.
It's phenomenal. It really is. Directed by Sidney Lumet, but written by Reginald Rose. And it was originally written as a live teleplay. So it was originally written for TV.
Did you ever see the TV remake?
Oh, the TV remake. There's been several remakes, but I don't think I've seen.
I remember there was one in the 90s.
Henry Fonda was one of the backers. He was a co-producer on the film. It's the only film he actually co-produced, and he'd never co-produced another film because he was so stressed about its success.
Can you imagine all those fucking actors? Like, yeah.
He never did it again. Yeah. It a very tight shoot. It was a very, very low budget. But oh my God, what a perfect little drama.
This genre, when it's got justice on its side,
yeah,
like Philadelphia, like The Accused or whatever, even though I didn't love that film like others have, but where there's a just cause, that moves me.
Yeah.
It's a poor slum kid who's been beaten and abused all his life, and his lawyer doesn't even give a shit about him. And it's an open and closed case. And you've got Henry Fonda who's like, hang on a minute, I'm not prepared to just throw this kid's life away. We're going to argue this out. And I don't care if you're pissed off because you're going to miss your ball game. He deserves it. And I'm going to tell you why. And that, to me, is riveting and so moving.
And it's, I think it's just this, like a masterclass exploration into the justice system, and particularly reasonable doubt. You know, mm-hmm. that fundamental linchpin in the justice system of reasonable doubt, because you can't be 100% sure. As a cinematic experience, it's just a masterclass to use that word again, because you have Henry Fonda, who's dressed in all white, this kind of like totem of quiet morality, versus the gamut of all types of people in around him. You've got guys who are complete racist bigots. You've guys who are religious, who just want to kind of, you know, who are immigrants who just want to get on with their lives and whatnot. But slowly, as you just said, to echo what you said, it's the same thing. He says, we need to give him a chance. We need to really consider what we're fucking doing right here. The tension that's built in the filmmaking is incredible. Like, you know, the way I noticed in that viewpoint, that
it never feels claustrophobic either.
But then I feel when it wants to turn the heat up, the filmmaking does literally turn the heat up. True. Yeah, it's the fan isn't working. They're sweating bucks. I'd say the room was stink. You can almost smell the sweat in the room. And also there's this use of, like, I think it's lens choice. I think Lumet expertly uses different lenses to kind of create a bit sense of space between the characters. But when things are getting tense, he just uses different types of lenses and kind of angles the camera differently, shoots from a different angle, so it's not boring.
When he chooses close-ups and when it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's dynamic, you know, and in its editing and its camera selection. But fucking, ultimately, it's timeless. It's one of those stories that you can show to any group of people at any time from now, I think, until the end of humanity, to actually illustrate a very important message, which is, hold on a second, we have to really consider our choices. We have to always explore reasonable doubt. When we have someone's fate in our hands, we always have to give everyone every chance possible.
And it hits at home at the very end, because almost the entire film takes place in that back room. But at the very, very end, when they're leaving the courthouse, and one of the guys asks the other guy his name, and they say, well, nice to meet you. And they walk off in different directions, and they all go their separate ways. And that is democracy at work. That is the justice system. But this film, if you were to watch it now for the first time, there are certain types of films that I've rewatched for this, like Judgment at Nuremberg, which is a very important film, and it's got great writing and great moments, but it feels of its time. Whereas 12 Angry Men, you can watch that right now. You could show that even to a bunch of like college students, and it will grip them, because it's a simple, direct story of one guy against 11 others. And he feels the kid on trial for murder is innocent, or at least he's not guilty as they're saying he is, and that he's going to make the case for him. That's just inherently dramatic, and it's so well done. And as I said, it's so moving, because he has a guardian in that room fighting for him. And that to me is like, what's more riveting than that? One person against the odds.
Yeah, going back to what we were saying earlier as well about like it almost feeling like a sports contest. It's an underdog. The drama of the story is an underdog story, because you've got that one guy who is going to, the Henry Fonda character, who is going to almost be, he's turned on by the group, by the gang. He's going to be ganged up on because he's...
Wait a minute. What are you saying? I don't give a damn. These are all the same, all these dirty little beatniks.
And another point that you brought up earlier on, the amount of fucking brilliant character actors in this fucking film. It's incredible. Faces you recognize.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's brilliant. I don't know if I said it, but Reginald Rose, he got the inspiration because he had to do jury duty and realized, hang on a second, Jesus, who the fuck are we to be deciding this poor individual's fate? And that was the inspiration to go on. And
I'd love to be on a jury. Some traffic violation with a cyclist. Guilty.
That'd be great.
That's life. That's life.
Yes. Go down. So that is my best pick, because I'm pretty sure your best pick is going to be one of my runner-ups. I'm pretty sure of it.
It is. It's Liar Liar.
Well, that's because you have big jugs.
I knew it. Good old Jim.
You ever served in an infantry unit, son?
No, sir.
Ever served in a forward area?
No, sir.
Ever put your life in another man's hands, ask him to put his life in yours?
No, sir.
We follow orders, son. We follow orders or people die. It's that simple. Are we clear?
Yes, sir.
Are we clear?
Crystal.
All those having business with this general court-martial, stand forward and you shall be heard.
The facts of the case are these. On midnight of September 6th, the accused entered the barracks room of their platoon mate. They woke him up, tied his arms and legs with tape, forced a rag into his throat. A few minutes later, a chemical reaction caused his lungs to begin bleeding. He drowned in his own blood and was pronounced dead at 37 minutes past midnight.
Do you think Santiago was murdered?
Private Santiago is dead, and that is a tragedy. But he is dead because he had no code. He is dead because he had no honor. And God was watching.
Your men follow orders or people die.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's gonna do it? You?
That if this case is handled in the same fast food, slick ass, Persian bazaar manner with which you seem to handle everything else, then something's gonna get missed.
In the heart of the nation's capital, in a courthouse of the United States government, one man will stop at nothing to keep his honor, and one will stop at nothing to find the truth.
Well, I saw A Few Good Men for the first time just for this topic. It's one of those films where the highlight reels are constantly used in anything that has to do with this genre or just, you know, it's become a staple of the movies in general. You can't handle the truth. It's one of those quotes that's just ubiquitous. And you know where you just get a sense of a film and it's like, well, I know what the big reveal is. So
yeah.
It'd be like being exposed to, I see dead people, they don't know they're dead, just constantly. And it kind of just kills your enthusiasm to experience that film because you know what the big reveal is, you know what the big moment is. So I never really had a good enough reason to go back and watch A Few Good Men.
So you have watched it. You have watched it.
Never before. Seen it.
Oh, this is your first time watching it?
My first time watching
it. Wow. Oh my goodness.
And there's a couple of moments. This was Aaron Sorkin's first film as a writer, and it was based on a play, and I'd love to know what the play was like, but there's a couple of Sorkinese moments that feel a little too West Wingy, where they're nauseating, and they only come at the very, very end. But other than that, this film blew me away for feeling so much like a sports movie, a pure crowd pleaser. Jack Nicholson as this ultimate villain, this horrible fucking colonel. The writing, Rob Reiner's direction, it all just worked for me. But what blew me away was Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
How did he not win the Oscar for Best Actor that year?
Problem was, it's public perception. He was Tom Cruise. That was this. You're not an actor, You're just a popcorn actor.
He's obviously an odd fish. He's a Scientologist and he's out to kill himself by fucking riding sharks and whatever. But he, in that era, was excellent. Like, he's playing this as a cocksure. It's almost like Maverick from Top Gun, but with smarts. He's like a quarterback, and this is a sports game for him. And it all builds to a head where he's going to put the colonel on the stand. And the only way he's going to win this case is if he gets him angry and he gets him to admit that he ordered the Code Red to carry out their own justice, which is to beat the shit out of this weak guy in their infantry who was struggling and he wanted to be swapped out. And I was just blown away by what an energetic, exciting film it was. And I was starting to flag on the genre because I was watching all these films, some I'd seen, some I'd not seen. I think I'd just come off The Accused and I was like getting exhausted by the objection sustained, overruled, all this kind of stuff. And this was about building a case, the case falling down, and you're up against the system. And you've got one guy who, he's trying to get out from under the shadow of his dad. And he's not right for the job, but he also is, if he can just focus in. And it just felt to me like a sports film. It was fucking excellent. And that scene between him and Jack Nicholson, so exciting to watch. And that is what surprised me. I expected an awful lot of these films to be a chore, and most of them were really exciting. And this is the most exciting of all of them.
Santiago was a substandard Marine. He was being transferred.
That's not what you said. You said he was being transferred because he was in grave danger.
That's correct.
You said he was in danger. I said grave danger. You said, is there any
other... I recall what I said.
I can have the court reporter read back to you.
I know what I said. I don't have to have it read back to me like I'm...
Why the two orders? Colonel?
Sometimes men take matters into their own hands.
No, sir. You made it clear just a moment ago that your men never take matters in their own hands. Your men follow orders or people die. So Santiago shouldn't have been in any danger at all, should he have, Colonel?
You snotty little bastard.
Your Honor, I'd like to ask for a recess.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
The court will wait for an answer.
It's a great film. And I think it's just one of those films that kind of just, its cover just gets lost in history because it's, as you said, it's become such a quote. It's become a part of our lexicon, cultural lexicon. You can't handle the truth. Performances are absolutely astounding. The one thing I would say about that is that the whole case relies on a Hail Mary.
But isn't that great dramatic stuff?
It is very good. You see that? It works in a movie. You see, it works in a movie where he says, I'm going to bait him. I'm going to bait him and I'm going to lure him in and see. But it's not real life courtroom stuff.
Not in the Irish sense. He's not going to bait the shite out. I'm going to bait 30 stockings of shite out.
No, he's going to lure him. He threw his line into the ocean. He wanted to catch the big shark. And it's a Hail Mary.
But the argument that Jack Nicholson makes is phenomenal, where he's like, you need me. You need this bastard, because I'm the guy standing between total anarchy.
I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled to.
And I just loved it. I thought it was fucking brilliant. And again, what I said about this podcast a few times, what I love about it is that it exposes me to films that I have overlooked, but now I have a reason to watch them, and I come away with another favorite film of all time. And A Few Good Men, to me, is a masterpiece of the genre, and it's my pick.
It's the gift of this podcast, which keeps on giving to me as well, Kevin. A great pick. It's in my top three. I think I could have swapped them around. So great pick.
Case closed. We did it.
Done. Move on. What's the next homework?
Well, the wheel is broke. So, I think we're heading towards our 75th episode, Will. Big milestone. Yeah. Huge milestone. It's coming out on our fourth anniversary. And I thought, for this entire time, we have been leaving up to chance, or leaving up to listeners, or leaving it up to patrons. And you picked this topic, and I loved it. So I'm going to pick your topic for you.
Oh God, right.
And it's going to be a really big, huge one, but I'm not going to tell you on this episode. You're going to have to I'm going to tell you off mic, but for everyone else, you're going to have something to look forward to. But it's one of the ultimate topics. We haven't covered it yet, and there's a reason why we're doing it this way, and all will be revealed soon. But tune in on the next Best Bits for our 74th episode.
Yes.
That's a big topic. Yes, it's a huge topic.
Yes. Okay.
Now for our usual closer, we'll take it away.
Hey, join our Patreon. Loads of bonus shows. Come over our Patreon. Join our Patreon for the price of coffee a month, because I think it's actually cheaper than even one coffee a month. You can also join our Discord, where we have our really, really passionate patrons. We all chat together and hang out, and where we discuss the latest news and just chill and socialize. And it's a wonderful little community that we have. And it's replaced social media for me, or Discord.
If you like this episode, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcast app of choice. That'll do, Will. I'll see you for the next episode.
Very good. I am
best action scene.
Damn it.
Best action scene. See ya.
Bye.
The Best Bits podcast is produced by Will and Kevin. All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider becoming a Patreon member, where you'll receive bonus shows where we talk about recent releases and what we're up to.
And you'll receive access to our Discord chat room, where we hang out with our listeners.
Search the Best Bits podcast on Patreon or click on the link in the show notes.
All right, enough. This is Helen.
And here is a clip from the lad's latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
We can't even do those on the main feed, right?
Mini Bits.
Will and Kev on the mic, talking shy.
It's up to you, whatever works.
The shame of it.
It's just €3.
Minimum. A month.
What a bargain.
Will and Kev on the mic, talk is shy.
Will and Kev,
Call
to the TV.
Hello, Kevin.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to another episode of the Mini Bits.
You're presenting yourself quite well. I accidentally, at the weekend...
It's because I shaved.
I accidentally... We're invited down for a meal at Karen's Cousins, and they're great hosts, and they had all down for a meal.
What would you do if you didn't like Karen's Cousins? Because they're right up your hole.
They don't see me. The ones I don't like don't really see much of me. That's keep my distance.
How many cousins do you have?
How many cousins do I have?
Do you have?
Oh, I couldn't count them. I've loads. I've absolutely loads. But I've only a third of what Karen has. Karen has, I would say, close to 100 cousins. First cousins.
No way.
Yes, because on one side, on the this side where I'm living, there was six siblings, right, as in aunts and uncles, right, and they all have families. But then on her mother's side, her mother came from a family of 13, so all of them have families with at least three children per family. So maybe it's not 100, but it feels like 100.
Couldn't be 100, Will, because my dad's one of two brothers, two sisters. That's five. So he's one of five, and my mom's one of 12.
Yeah. Oh, well, so it was similar.
But I've got 31 first cousins.
Oh, Karen's got way more than 31 first cousins.
So every one of you, her aunts and uncles were having like six, seven children.
No, when I say 100, I say it feels like 100.
Okay, that's very different.
Yeah.
Because you have three Irish people in a room and it feels like fucking 15.
Yeah. But I haven't even met all of her first cousins.
You've never met all of her first cousins? I've never met some of my first cousins.
Really?
I have a first cousin in...
You're so unsociable.
Denmark. Yeah, in Denmark. No.
Wouldn't you think you'd send them a card just to say hi?
I've never met the fucker. I have a cousin in Sweden. He's my first cousin and he's named after my dad, Vincent. Vincent Lehan in Sweden. He's my first cousin. Never met him.
I didn't know your dad's name was Vincent.
I'm sure it's come up. That's my middle name as well. I better not put that out there. That's my full like government ID going out there.
Oh, I thought you're... Okay, wow. I thought the V stood for villain. That's what I thought. Kevin villain.
Here we go. Tony two times at it again.
I'm shocked that you never met him. That you've never met... you have a first cousin you've never met.
Well, I lived in Ireland and he lived in Sweden. And... You know, listen, I didn't even grow up with my dad, so I have a whole... I have a very dysfunctional childhood. You don't want to get into it. You don't want to pull at that thread, Will.
I don't want to pull at that thread.
You really don't.
So going back to what happened at that meal, Luke came up and said, can I borrow your phone? And we want to use an app because they all want to do something on an app. And I went, right, okay, whatever. But my phone is bursting. It doesn't have any space. So I was like, you need to delete X amount of space. And I was randomly selecting apps to delete and inadvertently deleted my podcast app. And when I went the next day, I went in the car to turn on my podcast, you know, because I had no one else in the car. And I went, I'll just go into town. I'll put on a podcast and I'll just at least just listen to a podcast. And when I went to my phone to turn on my app was no longer there because I went, shit, I deleted it. And all those podcasts I was subscribed to are gone. So I don't even remember. So now it's like I've been forced to cull my podcast feed.
Mini Bits Raw.
But now you have to manually enter the RSS feeds for some of our podcasts.
Yeah.
So you won't even get this Mini Bits.
No, that's what I was going to ask you. That's one of the things I was going to... How do I get the Mini Bits on my phone?
Fuck yeah, you're not getting it.
I can't hear it. Yeah, oh God.
All right, I'm going to hit record in three.
We should do it. We should just restart. Oh God. Anyway. Right, so what have we been watching?
Do you know what I want to talk to you about first of all? Because I see it here right on your list. And
yes.
I just watched a TikTok on it. And I want to get your take on it. But it's The Brutalist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I watched The Brutalist.
So The Brutalist, right?
Yes.
They used AI in their film.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Did it not?
They did. And they did it in two places.
Right.
One, the architectural drawings that he draws at the end, they're all done by AI. And the other one is Adrian Brody's Hungarian accent is augmented by AI.
Stop.
Yeah. So that should disqualify him from the Oscars, shouldn't it?
Oh my God. That's so odd. That's so odd.
Yeah.
I was so annoyed. That annoys me. That triple annoys me. But the film now triple annoys me. Go on.
The director said that the Hungarian accent is very difficult to do and they wanted it to be not perfect. So I think it's called Respeecher. They augmented his pronunciation, you know, the way that I would do the TikTok voices, where it'd be like, have you seen my dog?
Have you seen my dog?
It's like, that's my voice, but it's augmented with a filter. They did something similar.
Just thought it was your neighbor. That's what I thought that it was. I watched The Brutalist. It genuinely took me a week to watch it. I had no idea what that film was. It only I saw it on my Oscars.
Couldn't get the VCR working.
No, I couldn't. I saw it on, the only reason it came into my awareness was I saw it on the screener list. I saw the poster with Adrian Brody's face and I just went, oh, there's a load of
films. No, not watching that. Not him with his nose. Turn it off.
I had no idea. It wasn't at all on my radar, at all. And then it won the Golden Globe for Best Film and Best Actor. And I said, oh, I'd better bloody well watch it. The first thing I saw, first thing that made me go, oh no, is that it is 215 minutes, which is 3 hours and 20 minutes long. And I went, okay, fuck. And I said, let's press play. And the first thing, it starts with a overture, like the way old movies used to do, where it's just black and the score is kind of building and you're getting your seat and stuff like that, as if we're in an old schooly cinema. The story then, in my mind, was a true life story. This was when I was watching it, I thought this was the true life story of this architect, this visionary architect who leaves Hungary, who immigrates. We pick up his story when he's immigrating to America, and we watch him as he goes from rags to, not riches, but rags to realization, where he was an architect. He was a visionary architect back before the war, but obviously he survived the camps and whatnot, and he comes to America and he settles in Pennsylvania, where he is patronized, to use it in its correct usage, by this wealthy, prominent industrious played by Guy Pearce.
Like our patrons.
Yeah, he's like our patrons.
Mini bits.